all of us have that dreaded thing that rings in the morning, that alarm clock that says, time to get up. Well, there was one time back in 1973, I was at the University of Minnesota, and I've worked nights. I was in the office for United Parcel Service and needed to show up at 4:30 in the morning. And so we had, in an effort to save fuel, they had daylight savings time almost year-round. And anyway, it was 6 o'clock, and I had taken a nap, and I woke up, and I thought I was late for work. I thought I was an hour and a half late, and then it took me half an hour to get over to work, and so forth. And I've pulled out all of my things, and I started working on my projects for the day, and my supervisor came over and he asked me, did I know what time it was? And I said, yeah, it's almost 6:30, and I'm 2 hours late, and I'm just really sorry for being so late. He said, well, actually, you're 10 hours early for work. It was dark outside. I ended up thinking it was morning, and it was indeed evening. Well, all of us have had funny experiences with alarm clocks. But in the Gospel of John, there is an alarm clock that is referred to a number of times. Jesus says on a number of occasions within John's Gospel, starting in John chapter 2, my hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. But in John chapter 12, in the passage that we considered, actually now it's several weeks ago, Jesus said that the hour had come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Take a look at John chapter 12, verse 20. Now, there were certain Greeks, actually, it should be understood as Grecians. These are Jewish people, as we've argued, but they were Greek-speaking. They were from other countries. They were part of the Jewish diaspora. There were certain Grecians among those who came up to worship at the feast. The fact that they were going to worship is an indication that they are at least proselytes, but in all probability, they are ethnically Jewish. And so in the process, Jesus is told that they want an audience with him. Look at his response to his two disciples that told him this. Verse 22 or 23. But Jesus answered them, saying, the hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Complete change of direction. Up until this point, the issue has been, my hour has not yet come. Move forward to verse 27. That's where our passage will start today. Jesus says, now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? And he asked, should I say, Father, deliver me from this hour? But for this purpose I came to this hour. Now look at 13:1. Now before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end or to the uttermost. We'll talk about those exegetical options when we get there next time. But notice, Jesus is now within the hour. So, let's see. Sorry. This is going to be the outline that we're going to present on the passage that the first section will be his passion prediction. He's predicting that he will be crucified. Then there will be John recapping the flow of the narrative of John's Gospel in 12:36b through 43. And then in verses 44 through 50, Jesus will have a private debriefing with his disciples. We're now looking at his final public passion prediction. And let me back up a little bit here. The overall flow of this book, we started with his baptism. That's actually not recorded in John's Gospel. It is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Then Pesach, that stands for Passover. It's a shorter word, that's why I have it. So we have a total of four Passovers during Jesus' ministry, three of which are mentioned in John's Gospel. The second one is mentioned, or at least alluded to, in Luke chapter 6. Then all of a sudden, starting in John chapter 7, we have a series of other feasts that are in between the last two Passovers. Sukkot, otherwise known as the Feast of Booths, and then Hanukkah, or dedication, in John chapter 10, the last part. We are at this point in the book right at the verge of the fourth Passover. Jesus was crucified on the Passover, the fourth Passover. Afterwards, Book of Acts picks up with the day of Pentecost. Okay. The way that I have come to see the hour, Jesus is saying, up until John chapter 12, my hour has not yet come. So that's before the hour. But now, here we are at 12:01 on the clock, and it is during the hour. And that lasts a section of the book, and then we have events that are after the hour. Here's how that lays out. John 1 through 11 is before the hour begins. John 12:1 through 19:30 is in that hour. That hour is the time between Palm Monday. It is not Palm Sunday. We talked about that last time. The chronology works out that it was Monday. It was not Sunday. There are two arguments within the Gospel of John that show that. We covered that the last time we were in the flow of the context in John. And that lasts all the way up until his crucifixion in 1930. 1930 is where he dies. After that, then, is after the hour. So you'll notice we have 11 chapters that are before the hour. And then this very short period of time between Monday and Friday of the week in which he was put to death occupies all of 12:1 through 19:30. And then a relatively short section of John is after the hour, John 19:31 through the end of the book. We need to look at the book of Daniel in order to understand all of the background on this. Daniel is going to tell us what this hour is all about and why it was that Jesus could not be crucified up until after Palm Monday. If he were crucified prior to that, if he were to die before that, Daniel would have spoken a falsehood. Daniel has a timetable. We're going to look at that. We're going to consider it fairly quickly. We're not going to go into a lot of depth on it, but we will consider Daniel's timetable. But in the year 605 BC, this is before the final conquest of Jerusalem in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar sent members of the royal family off to Babylon. They were hostages, and if you have read the book of Daniel, they were to be educated in all the ways of the Babylonians, but they were hostages. The idea was that if the governing officials in Jerusalem became rebellious and started not doing the things that Babylon wanted, bad things would happen to their sons, nephews, and grandchildren, and so on and so forth. So in 605 BC, there was a deportation of people of the royal family, among whom we have Daniel. They are important officials' children that were sent as hostages in order to ensure that the government would do what the Babylonians wanted them to do. So Daniel arrived in Israel perhaps as a young teenager, and we find him 66 years after the point that he was sent to Babylon in Daniel chapter 11. So where the arrow is pointing, Daniel is a book that is not set in chronological order. Most of the chapters have a date stamp in the first verse of the chapter. So we know the date of each chapter of Daniel by looking at that, but the book is not arranged chronologically. This isn't time to explain how it is arranged. I've covered that when we did a series on Daniel in a prior year. But in Daniel chapter 9, verse 2, what I'll do is I'll start giving that date stamp in verse 1. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the lineage of the Medes, the conquering power was Media Persia. So the Medes and the Persians, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans were the ruling astrological party in Babylon. They were the ones that had taken over Babylon. So when it refers to the Chaldeans, it is referring to the country of Babylon, but it's looking at the powerful elite. In the first year of his reign, so that's how we know the date of this chapter, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Israel, of Jerusalem. So after the final conquest of Jerusalem, or of Judah, in the year 586, there was a massive deportation of Judeans over to Babylon. So it wasn't just the royal family. Now, at this time in 586, we have just massive amounts of people from the country were exiled. And what the Babylonians did is similar to what the Russians did often. And my own family testifies of that, because Finland was controlled by Russia at the time that my grandfathers were born in Finland, and my great-grandmothers as well. And they would have a tendency that if you entered the Russian army, you would never get back to your homeland if you were part of any of the colonial territories conquered by Russia. So that included Finland. So each of my maternal grandfather's brothers left the country when they were approaching draft age in order to escape the Russian draft. But Daniel is reading in Jeremiah. And Jeremiah had a prophecy. And it says that after the 70 years are completed at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you and cause you to return to this place. So Daniel is thinking, we are in the 66th year. soon, God is going to allow the nation to return back to Judah. That happened under Ezra and Nehemiah. But that caused Daniel to pray. And my analysis here is going to be drawing heavily upon writings of my dissertation advisor, Harold Honer from Dallas Seminary. Sorry for the misspelling of analysis, but he did a major study to come up with dates during the life of Jesus. And a major part of dating things within the life of Jesus is to understand Daniel chapter 9. So he devoted an entire chapter to that. So I'll give you a little bit of Hebrew. This is the word Shavuah. It says here, noun masculine, and it appears in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. It means a period of 7, but it can be days, like a week, or it can be used for a group of 7 years. It could be translated heptad. Heptad is a group of 7. A week is a group of 7, but we attach the word week to a group of 7 days. Here we're needing to think in terms of a period of 7 years. And so they note that both in Daniel as well as in Ezekiel, this term is used to stand for 7 years, a heptad or 7 years. So all of this is quoting from Brown, Driver, and Briggs lexicon, which is one of the major lexicons for the Hebrew language. So, to give a very quick, rough and ready timeline, Daniel points to a particular covenant, a particular decree that is going to set out a starting point. So remember, Daniel is praying in this whole intervening section that God would indeed fulfill the Abrahamic covenant and fulfill the promise that was recorded in Jeremiah, that the 70 years would be the end of the desolation in Babylon and the people would be sent back to Judah. So let's start at verse 24. 70 heptad, 70 weeks, 70 weeks of years is the idea, are determined for your people, that would be for the nation of Judah, the southern kingdom, and for your holy city, that is for Jerusalem. Under normal circumstances, I would take time to discuss the 6 things that are prerequisite for the millennium, but we're not here in this looking at issues related to the tribulation or the millennium. So I'm not going to be looking at all at verse 27. We're just here concerned with dating things regarding when Jesus could be crucified, because this prophecy is going to talk about that. So let's resume at verse 25. Daniel is told, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem." Remember, Jerusalem has been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and it hasn't been rebuilt in the meantime. "There shall be 7 heptads," 49 years, "and 62 heptads." So the first 7 weeks, the 7 heptads, will be up through 396 BC, and this was how long it took for the city to be rebuilt. There shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again. In other words, things are going to be restored within the city and the wall. So this is a complete restoration. It's not referring just to the walls. Nehemiah, in the book of Nehemiah, is connected with the walls being rebuilt. But the city itself is going to be restored. And it's going to happen in troublesome times. If you read in Nehemiah, you find that the local inhabitants, and by the way, when Babylon evicted Jewish people out of the land, they moved a lot of other people of other ethnicities in. So the locals were no longer friendly people for Nehemiah. Babylon believed in mixing things up so that people were less able to rebel against them. Verse 26. And after these 62 weeks, now it's after the 7 plus 62, because the 7 heptads occurs first. After the 62 heptads, Messiah shall be cut off. He'll be killed, but not for himself. It's not because of any sin that he did. It's not because of any wrong that he did. But he would be cut off after the completion of the 62 heptads, which occurs after the first 7. Honer has calculated that the completion of the 69 heptads, the 7 plus 62, would be on March 30th, AD 33. Lo and behold, that is Palm Monday. And this is when Messiah enters the city of Jerusalem as prince, not as king. He was ready to be coronated, but he was not coronated at that. So the triumphal entry, he enters as prince, not as king. But notice down below the box, after the 69th week, April 3rd, AD 33, that is the date when Jesus was crucified. But there's another event that happens after the 69th. And that is in also in verse 26. And the people of the prince who is to come, that is the Romans, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. In April of AD 70, Titus began the siege of Jerusalem. Now, I will say a little bit about verse 27. Verse 27 is talking about events that occur during the 70th heptad. Remember, 70 heptads are decreed for your city and for your people. So we have events in verse 25 that are during weeks or heptads 1 through 69. In verse 27, we have events that are during the 70th. But as we look at verse 26, it is events that are after the end of the 69th, but before the beginning of the 70th. This is how we know that there is a gap between the events. The tribulation is yet future. And so verse 27 speaks about that yet future 7-week return to the age of Israel that we know as the tribulation. But our purpose here is to note March 30th, the triumphal entry, which occurred earlier in John chapter 12. Actually, tell you what, take a look in John 12 and let's see that. John chapter 12, starting at verse 12. The next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel. Then Jesus, when he had found a young donkey, sat on it, as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion. "Behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt." His disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, they remembered that these things were written about him and that they had done these things to him. Therefore, the people who were with him when he called Lazarus out of his tomb, chapter 11, and raised him from the dead bore witness. For this reason, the people also met him. In other words, the crowd increased. The people who had seen him raise Lazarus were talking very excitedly and gathering a very large crowd. For this reason, the people also met him, because they heard that he had done this sign, the sign of raising Lazarus from the dead. And then in verse 20, we have certain Grecians. And then we have Jesus saying in verse 20, "The hour has come." It is on this day, March 30th, AD 33, Palm Monday, the triumphal entry, that the first 69 heptads have reached their conclusion. I would strongly recommend purchasing Honer's Chronological Aspects if you want to get a more detailed look at this, or you can look back to our Daniel series and look at the messages on Daniel chapter 9. Let's set up the chronology a different way. On the left-hand side, we have a rock pile. That's because Nebuchadnezzar has laid siege to the city and broke down walls. 396 BC is when the first 7 weeks have been completed. And then in AD 33, we have Palm Monday. And we also, after the completion of the 62, that is after the 7 plus 62, we have the cross also in 33. And then we have the conquest, the siege of Jerusalem in the year 70. So this is a very important passage for establishing chronology. This is why Jesus could say he was safe. Even in John chapter 11, he made it clear to his disciples they were going back to Judea. They were going to Bethany, which is less than 2 miles away from Jerusalem, which is where his enemies were headquartered. But he said, are there not 12 hours in a day? Daylight signified the time that he was alive, he was safe. But then nighttime comes when no man can work, as he said in John chapter 11. That's looking at the point when he would die. So, we have events that are before the hour. We have events during the hour, chapter 12, up through 1930. Then we have events after the hour. This, by the way, is a half a clock face. So, let's take a look at what Jesus said in verse 27. "Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, deliver me from this hour? No. But for this purpose I came to this hour." He's saying, no, I will not ask to be delivered. I will not ask to be spared from the hour. I didn't drop in any slides, but I think I'd like to take an excursus for a moment. Go back to Matthew chapter 26. This is a passage that has bothered many people. You could do a search for this article. I wrote an article in Grace and Focus. So if you go to the GES website, and they have a search engine. You can search for my last name and then "take this cup from me." So if you do a search for my last name and "take this cup from me," you'll come up with an article that I wrote about this passage and the parallels where Jesus is in Gethsemane and he has prayers. And many people think, this is the prevailing position, that Jesus is praying for the Father not to let him go to the cross. There's a real problem with that. Jesus is the greater than Moses prophet like Moses, the Deuteronomy 18 prophet that Moses predicted. And one of the requirements is that everything that a prophet would say, and he is the prophet, not just a prophet, but he is the prophet. Anything that the prophet or a prophet said needed to come true. Jesus cannot escape the cross. He has been predicting it all the way since John chapter 2, verse 21. But if we look here as he is in Gethsemane, I'll read it in the way that people often do and where they think that he's trying to escape from the cross. We'll see evidence in this passage that no, he is not. Matthew chapter 26, starting at verse 36. Then Jesus came with them, that is, with his disciples, to a place called Gethsemane, and said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go and pray over there." And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and greatly distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death." Notice that is similar to what is said in John chapter 12, verse 27. "Stay here and watch with me." Now, there are days removed between this. John chapter 12 occurs on Monday, Palm Monday, but this is dated on Thursday, the night before his crucifixion. Verse 39, "He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.'" And it's typically been understood, if there's a way that I don't have to go to the cross, take it away from me, but if you want me to go to the cross, I will. "Then he came to his disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, 'What, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit itself indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.' Again, a second time he went away and prayed, saying, 'O my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done.'" If we look very closely at this, Jesus is here setting forth his expectation that he has to drink of the cup. That is, he has to be crucified. So what's he asking for when he speaks of, "Let this cup pass from me," but he expects to drink it? He's not trying to escape the cross. What he's saying is, "Father, bring this about quickly. Let this happen soon. Don't let it drag out. But I am willing to wait as long as your timetable has me wait. But if we can speed this up, that's what I'm asking for." He wasn't asking to escape the cross. He was asking, "Don't let the preliminaries drag on and on and on." Okay, let's go back to verse 27 of John 12. "Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, deliver me from this hour? No. But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." What does he mean? Father, glorify your name. Yeah, we have songs about that. But how is the Father going to glorify his name? let's look at the answer that the Father gives in verse 28. Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have both glorified and I will glorify again. But again, the question is, how? How? Very good. John's Gospel has recorded 7 signs that occurred prior to this point. Remember the purpose statement of John, John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these, the 8 signs, have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing, have life in his name. Let's back up to John chapter 1, verse 14. And the Word, that's Jesus Christ, became flesh and dwelt among us. Actually, the Greek here is he tabernacled. He dwelt in a tent. A reminder back of the tabernacle of the Old Testament. Among us, and the us would be the 11, his disciples. And we, the 11, beheld his glory. Take a look at John chapter 2. Verse 1, we have the wedding. And if you look at the pictures up here, I have the water vases pictured, 6. And we have the wedding, and he turned it into wine. But look at the result of this. Verse 11, John chapter 2. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory. He showed his glory by doing a sign that he was directed to do by the Father. Jesus says elsewhere in the book, but he's going to say it often here in the passage we're looking at, everything he says, everything he does is at the Father's directive. The signs that he's doing are manifestations of his glory. Sign number 7 was the raising of Lazarus, and he told the sisters when they sent word to him saying, the one whom you love is sick. He said, this sickness will not end in death, but it is for the glory of God that the Son of God may be glorified through it. That's John chapter 11, verse 4. The signs are a manifestation of his glory. They're showing who he is, but it also glorifies the Father. The fact that everything that Jesus is doing is at the direction of the Father makes it so everything glorifies the Father. But since the Father has authorized the signs, the Father has glorified his name by giving the directive for Jesus to do the sign that then resulted in glory for both the Father and for the Son. Second sign, Jesus healed the nobleman's son from a distance. Third sign, he healed a man who had been lame for 38 years. Then we have the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus walked on water and transported the boat to the shore instantaneously. He gave sight to a man who had been born blind, and he raised Lazarus from the dead. Each of these signs has glorified Christ and the Father. The Father and the Son worked in coordination with one another, and so the Son is able to ask for the Father to glorify his name. And how will he do so? Through the signs. But wait a moment, you say, that was future. This is past. Signs 1 through 7 have already occurred. But sign 8, the cross and resurrection, lo and behold, in John chapter 2, when pressed, what sign authorized Jesus to cleanse the temple? He said, destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. And he was referring to the sanctuary of his body. He was predicting that he would be crucified, but then resurrected. That's the eighth sign. What we have here is the Father is saying, I have glorified my name through your signs, and I will do it again. The Father is promising to raise Jesus from the dead. Very fascinating interchange. You notice, not a cloud in the sky. No indication that there are clouds that day. There might have been, but no indication of it. Verse 29. Therefore the people who stood by and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said an angel spoke to him. Jesus is going to clarify, no, you heard the voice, you heard the sound, but you didn't understand it. It's going to be sort of like the nation Israel. The nation Israel also does not catch on. So this is a ditto for the nation a little later on. They're going to be said not to have caught on, just like these hearers that day. What Jesus is going to do be is like passing a cell phone and say, hey, the phone call's for you. Verse 30. Jesus answered and said, this voice did not come because of me, but for your sake. Jesus already knew. He knew it was a sure thing because he and the Father were in always in perfect harmony for all of eternity. It's no surprise to him. He didn't need that to be audible for him to know that the Father was promising to raise him, and that the Father would indeed glorify him just as he already has. But Jesus now looks at further significance of the cross. All of this, now that the hour has come, Jesus' focus here in John chapter 12, as well as in the last discourse, 13 through 17, is going to be upon his upcoming crucifixion. He's very much focused upon that because one of the things that he has to do is stabilize his disciples, because this is just going to upset their entire apple cart. They have been with him for over 3 years, and now it's, how does it all go together now? And he's having to prepare them and show them that he's completely in control. He knows what is going to happen to him. He's in charge. And he's not one that's running away from what he's facing. But what he is doing is starting the groundwork of preparing his disciples for this. He said, now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. Satan is going to suffer a strategic defeat at the cross. He awaits yet future, having judgment executed upon him, where things come to pass, where he's confined during the millennial kingdom, he's defeated, and then ultimately is cast into the lake of fire. But Jesus is looking at the cross, is going to take out strategically the number one enemy, Satan. Verse 32 is another prediction of his crucifixion. And interestingly, the people around him figured it out this time. Jesus has at other times spoken of being lifted up. Remember when he spoke of Moses lifting up a serpent back in, the bronze serpent back in John chapter 3. He said, even so, the Son of Man must be lifted up. At that point, people didn't understand that he was referring to the cross, but he was. He says, if I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all to myself. Now, your translation may add the word people in italics, all peoples, but this is, that interestingly is a Calvinistic insert, because they're wanting to say he's going to draw people from all people groups, but they would deny that he draws universally. And so the addition of a word in italics is designed to make the Calvinists a little more comfortable. Remember, italics say that the translator thinks that the word is implicit, though not explicit in the Greek. In this case, I would say they are wrong. So if you have an italicized word there, it should be crossed out. He says, I will draw all to myself. Is he talking about forcing everyone to believe? You know, the Calvinist understands this in a way that they say that drawing is against people's will. They say, you know, when you draw a sword out of its sheath, there's resistance. And so he's pulling against resistance and so on and so forth. We can understand this instead in terms of inviting or attracting. It's a much kinder, much gentler approach, but it is universal. He even draws those who will never come. That is, will never come all the way to the point of believing, but he is wooing, he is seeking to attract. And indeed, that's even what he's doing right here. Consistently, Jesus ministers to people, though they are antagonistic to him. And that's what he's doing here. He is seeking to draw them. Now, further implication of this, if I am lifted up. John gives us an editorial remark. He said this, signifying by what death he would die. And you say, I don't get it. Normally, the procedure for execution by Jews was stoning. And there are at least two occasions, according to John's Gospel, one in John chapter 8, one in John chapter 10, where people actually picked up stones and they were prepared to stone Jesus to death. But later on, we're going to run into a fascinating passage later on in the Gospel of John, in which the Judeans say, no, we don't want to kill him, and they handed him over to the Romans. And as a result, the form of execution changed. And note is made that this is in keeping with Jesus predicting the kind of death he would die. He was going to die on a cross. He was not going to have bones broken. It was the type of death that Psalm 22 anticipates. Well, this raised a question. because the people figured out, hey, wait a moment, he's talking about dying. But how can the Messiah die? The Messiah has to reign forever. If he's going to reign forever, he can't die. So they say, the people answered in verse 34, we have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever, and how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? Now, if you'll notice very carefully, as you look at verses 30 through 32, John has not recorded the words Son of Man. We have to remember, anytime you have a citation, it's brief, it's an abbreviated, it's an accurate citation, but it's not a complete citation of all that was said. And so Jesus clearly has referred to himself as Son of Man in this context, and they were saying, well, wait a moment, from Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, we take it that you are using Son of Man as a term that would equal the Christ, the Messiah. But wait a moment, the Messiah has Christ, the Messiah, Christ just being the Greek translation of the word Messiah, he remains forever. How can you say this? They're saying, it seems to us that you are disproving the notion that you could be the Christ because you're talking about dying and we don't think the Messiah can die. Now there's a very simple answer, something that neither the Judeans who are arguing with Jesus at this point nor even his disciples had figured out. They figure out, okay, he's talking about dying. And we don't think the Messiah can die. Lifting up is a clear reference to the cross. But the crucified and resurrected Messiah will remain forever. The Old Testament does not say that he can't die. In fact, it requires him to die. Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, among other places. He needed to die. The Old Testament predicted it. But the Old Testament also predicts that he would be raised. And Psalm 22 gets into that as well. Because Psalm 22 talks about the millennial banquet that will be headed up by the Messiah. And although it described his death, he is going to be the one there leading the teaching on that particular occasion. And so the crucified and resurrected Messiah will remain forever. The problem was they hadn't come to terms with how is it that he could die and still remain forever. The resurrection is the solution. Resurrection is a crucial point. You might say, could they have been expected to have understood that? I would say so. And the reason I would say that is that way back with Abraham, Hebrews makes the comment that Abraham believed that God would raise his son Isaac after he would put him to death in Genesis 22. But that commentary is actually drawing upon what Genesis itself is pointing to. Abraham was told that he was going to inherit the land with its full borders described in Genesis 15, but he would inherit it after his death. His death was also predicted in Genesis chapter 15. He would die at a ripe old age. And yet the land would be his and his seeds forever. The Old Testament made promises of resurrection of believers. That's the only way. Without resurrection and eternal life, it's the only way that the Abrahamic covenant, the promises that God has made, can be fulfilled. If people can be resurrected, why couldn't the Messiah be resurrected? Furthermore, the Old Testament predicts it. Well, Jesus continued to speak. In verse 35, he said, "A little while longer, the light is with you. Truth is still with you because I'm here. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. This man, unless he has a flashlight, is soon going to be going down this rock pile in the dark. That's a recipe for tripping. That's a recipe for a spill. Jesus is urging these people, don't take your time. I don't have much longer. Turns out he's speaking on Monday. Friday, he's going to be crucified. Thursday, he's going to be out of reach as he goes through all of his trials that night. So then, in the next verse, verse 36, while you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light. He's saying, you have an opportunity now. He's urging them to believe his message, that they might have eternal life as he has promised. Okay, so he has made his final passion prediction, his final public passion prediction. This now is going to be an appropriate point, since his public ministry has ended, for John to recap what has taken place there during Jesus' public ministry. He does so in verses 36b through 43. So this is the recap. These things Jesus spoke and departed and was hidden from them. He went away. He said, yeah, believe soon, because I'm not going to be here long. And as part of an object lesson, he left. He went away. He was hidden from them. Verse 37 then says, although he did so many signs before them. Now, John's purpose statement in John 20, 30, and 31 says, many other signs Jesus did beyond the eight that are recorded in this book. Beyond that, when we look at John chapter 2, when Jesus was at the Passover feast, it says that many believed in him because they saw the signs he was doing during the feast. Nicodemus's opening words to Jesus in John 3:2 were, Rabbi, we, please note, we, Nicodemus came with a group of his disciples. Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no man can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. John chapter 6, verse 3 speaks about great crowds following him as Passover was approaching because of the signs which he had performed upon the sick. Besides that, we have other signs that are recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So Jesus has done a great number of signs, but the seven signs that John has recorded are sufficient. He's giving an indictment of the nation, and in particular of the leadership of the nation. despite the fact that he had given convincing proof, doing what no man could do, giving messianic signs, we are told they did not believe in him. And this is in order that, verse 38, the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he said, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Isaiah's day, most of the nation rejected his message. Jesus' day, a great bulk of the nation rejected his message. And so the recap is saying there has been overwhelming rejection by the nation. Now, in the next passage, we're told, let's say I have slides a little bit out of order, so I'll end up talking to them as I come to the slides. Therefore, they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, he blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, lest they should see with their eyes, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them. Israel became blind. Notice this is not talking about what the Calvinist wants to make it out to be. Calvinists want to talk about a constitutional blindness, sort of like this German Shepherd puppy, born blind. Now, German Shepherd puppy, presumably, after a few days, is going to open its eyes and it will be able to see. But it's talking about the blinding of hearts and eyes, hardening of hearts and blinding of eyes of people who were once sighted and once who did not have a hard heart. Have the heart of stone there, and then we have the welding, the arc weld, and blinding. You can't see exactly what's going on there at the point where the metal is being fused. It's too bright. You have to shield your eyes because it will damage the eyes, just like looking at the sun will damage the eyes. Israel became blind. It is not that God in eternity past made it blind and it never had sight. It is that God, at a point in time, blinded them. He blinded them through Isaiah's ministry. It's not they were already blind. I'm not talking about something that happened in eternity past. I'm not talking about people being, shall we say, using the Calvinist terminology, totally having total inability. That is not what this is talking about. And furthermore, the Bible doesn't talk about that either. It's not the appropriate place for me to go onto that subject, but we'll say that here. We have two types of blinding that could happen. So when you see blinding, you have to ask in Scripture, is it a blinding that happens with darkness, or is it a blinding that happens with light? Now, this is the Tower Sudan up in Tower, Minnesota. It's now a state park. When a person is in that, which unfortunately this year, you cannot go underground there. They're having to do restoration underground to make it safe again. My brother and I will be... We're planning to get up there, and Steve Mahoney as well, but up to the northern Minnesota. But under normal circumstances, I'd like to go to the Tower Sudan mine. There are some people that will be there that on that trip that will not have never been there. But the type of blinding that I'm going to talk about here is what happens when you're almost half a mile underground and you turn off the lights. You start out and it's bright, and they turn out most of the lights and have only one light on, and then all the lights off. Then you can have your hand an inch in front of your eye and you cannot tell that it's there. You cannot see a thing. But then a very small light, like this candle, suddenly seems very bright when it's compared to pitch darkness. This is blinding by darkness, the taking away of light. That's the type of blinding that Satan does. Is that the type of blinding that God is doing here? Type 1 is illustrated by putting blinders on. This picture here, the main picture, you're looking at headlights. Can anyone tell me what model of car that is? No, you can't. You can't make out any of the features when you are driving at night and someone has their high beams and they're glaring right in your eyes. You can't see very well. You have to focus away from the headlights to actually drive safely on a two-lane road. God blinds by an overabundance of truth. Not the way that Satan blinds, by the removal of light, the hiding of truth. In 2 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4, Paul says, "But if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age," that's Satan, "has blinded, lest they," the light of the glory, Christ, who is the image of God, should shine upon them. But this curtain on the right-hand side is illustrating a veil. God is capable of shining truth that's able to penetrate the satanic veil. Verse 6, remember I cited 2 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4. "God, who causes light to shine out of darkness," that's looking back at creation, "has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the image of Christ." God penetrates the satanic veil with light. Satan tries to hide light. He tries to darken things. So in our passage, we're going to want to figure out, what kind of blinding is occurring? Is it that God put a blanket over the people and made it so that they couldn't see and it was impossible for them, or he took out that part of their mind for them to be able to comprehend what Isaiah was saying? No, not at all. So the question is, what type of blinding is occurring there? Now, I'm sorry, this came out much brighter than it had looked there on my the screen of my laptop. Imagine that this page is a lot darker, but even so, even when it's blown up, it's just impossible to read. I have no idea what book this is that she's reading. We can't believe what she is reading because we can't see what she is reading clearly. Why do I make that point? Look at verse 39. "Therefore they could not believe because," Isaiah said again, "he has blinded their eyes." Now it's going to be important for us to figure out, how was it that the blinding occurred? I'd like for you to go back to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah is a little bit past the halfway point of your Bible. Isaiah chapter 6. And this is the beginning of Isaiah's ministry. "In the year that King Uzziah died," and I'll have a slide a little later, we know the date of that. This is the beginning of Isaiah's ministry. I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. So, above it, and then we have a seraphim, and the cry goes forth, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory," and so on and so forth. But the message that Isaiah finds out that he is going to need to report is one that people are not going to welcome. And so he asks the question, "How long, Lord?" Because listen to what he's told in verse 9. "Go and tell this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and return and be healed." Then I said, "Lord, how long?" And he answered, "Until cities are laid waste and without inhabitant." Okay, I'm going to ask a question here. Can you believe this? Olime Urdus Aloisa. Can you believe it? Olime Urdus Aloisa. We are in the United States. Well, you can believe that. They got so tired of hearing Isaiah that they stopped listening, and it would be just like it's written and finished to them. They couldn't figure out what Isaiah was saying because they weren't listening. They were so tired of it that they couldn't stand it. He says, "How long is this message going to go on? How long am I going to carry this message?" Isaiah would sound like a broken record because all the way through his life he preached this. But he kept preaching it. There's more and more and more and more and more light. But Judah is rejecting it because they aren't listening. It's not because they don't understand Isaiah's words. It's because they're not listening. He had that ministry for 66 years until his death, but 94 more years until cities fell, until the destruction of Jerusalem. Isaiah had a message that was not welcomed, and the people, though they understood what he was saying, didn't believe it, didn't respond to it. Well, that's like what he said here about Jesus. Though Jesus did so many signs before them, he kept turning up the light and kept turning up the light, and he kept teaching and he kept in front of the public's eye and he kept the message of truth coming forth. They couldn't explain how he did his signs. They couldn't confound him, but they rejected his message. This is blindness in spite of bright headlights. This is not satanic darkening. That's not the method of blinding. It's the welding light. It's the sun, and you can't look at it. It is so bright. Those that were opposed to it just turned away. They couldn't look at it. They rejected it. Okay. Sorry. Although he had done so many signs before them. And so, as I said, I had slides out of order. I was picturing the Solomonic temple when in the vision in Isaiah 6. But we have a fascinating passage that comes up here. Go back to John chapter 12. We're told in verse 41, "These things Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him." But then in verse 42, "Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. The great Sanhedrin is the ruling council in Jerusalem. It consisted of 71 leading Judeans. The Sadducees were the majority party, the Pharisees were the minority party. So there were at least 36 Sadducees and no more than 35 Pharisees. It probably was a greater preponderance of Sadducees than that. But the impression we get from the text is that over half of the Pharisees were opposed to Jesus. Rulers is down to this 71 men. When he's talking in verse 42, nevertheless, even among the rulers, even among the 71, many believed in him. Well, there wouldn't be any of the Sadducees that would have believed in him. So many of the rulers is looking at a significant minority of less than 35 Pharisees. Let's assume it was 35 of them. Well, at least 50% of them, enough to vote that the Pharisees were confident that they would win any vote. That is, that they would win a vote among them to have Jesus crucified, to turn him over to the Romans so he could be crucified. They then had to persuade the Sadducees to join in. That happened. The point when the Sadducees joined in and were also willing to have Jesus put to death was in John 11. We talked about that a couple of months ago. But there can't be more than 17 Pharisees that were believers. But that group of less than 17 is described as even among the rulers, many. So you have to say, how many will many be out of a group of no more than 17? 5? 7? Has to be more than one. We have Nicodemus, and we have Joseph of Arimathea named, but there were others. Then we have an ominous statement that says they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. Now the question is this a critique of Nicodemus? And I say absolutely not. This is not a critique of Nicodemus. This is a critique of Nicodemus's disciples, believers among the Pharisees, believers among the rulers, but it is not a description of Nicodemus himself. Let's see why. When he came at night, it wasn't that he came out of fear. Nicodemus is not a man of fear. I've demonstrated that back in our lessons on John chapter 3, so you can go back to those on the website. I don't have time to develop it at length, but he didn't come out of fear. That's when busy people meet, and the Pharisees were busy, the rulers were busy, and Jesus was also busy during the Passover. Nighttime is time to meet. People say, well, you know, it's nighttime, it's dark. Dark symbolizes evil. Wait a moment. The opposite of what happened with Judas. Judas went out from the light, John 13:30, into the darkness. But Nicodemus came out of the darkness into the light, into the presence of Jesus. And he kept asking questions, saying, I don't quite get it. Could you clarify further? Jesus would make it a little simpler. I still don't get it. Break it down. Help me understand. Nicodemus wanted to understand because he said, we know you are a teacher come from God, for no man can do these things unless God is with him. And the way that the passage is set up, end of chapter 2, beginning of chapter 3, Nicodemus is an illustration of one of the many who came to believe in him. Verse 23 of chapter 2 mentions the many who believe in him. But you'll notice the word man, 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 man keeps coming up. And he is an illustration of the men who is an exemplar out of those who believed in him. In John chapter 7, Nicodemus stood up to his fellow rulers when they were ready to lynch Jesus. And he said, does our law judge a man before it hears him and knows what he's doing? He stopped lynching. People are often quick to say, well, we don't see a confession of Jesus, but wait a moment. They knew that he was defending Jesus, and they knew that he was stopping them because he was showing that they were not planning to use the law legally in the way that they were about to try Jesus. And he stopped it, and they called him names, they ridiculed him, but they did not at that point go forward with the lynching that they were attempting to do. Nicodemus stopped it. That is a man of courage, and it is preposterous to say otherwise. John chapter 19, he and Joseph of Arimathea came in order to assist with the burial of Jesus. They buried him in a rich man's tomb, and it was necessary to get permission from Pilate, and they did so. But wait a moment. Crucifixion meant that Jesus had been declared an enemy of the state, and they were saying, we are friends of that enemy of the state, and they were not afraid to do so. Nicodemus does not show tendencies of fear. Furthermore, the rabbinic literature about him is fascinating. Don't have time to get into that. He is not a man of fear. If John 12:42 is not about Nicodemus, about whom does it speak? There were other rulers that loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. Those are the ones that are being critiqued here. Remember, in John 3:2, Nicodemus said, Rabbi, we know. But now, since I live down in the South, it's become very natural to say, y'all. And interestingly, in John chapter 3, we have uses of y'all. When Jesus speaks to, he addresses himself to Nicodemus, but he's speaking to the larger group. He says, if I've told you earthly things, if I've told y'all earthly things and y'all don't believe, how will y'all believe if I tell y'all heavenly things? Jesus is addressing a larger group. And that's, I think, quite evident within the context. This now leads us to the debriefing, which is the final section. Jesus is now going to speak words that are not in public. We saw that Jesus, in verse 36b, after he had spoken his last passion prediction to the public, he departed and he was hidden from them. But as you look at verse 44, it starts out with a then. And the then is telling us this is happening afterwards. But it's not after what is not narrative. Verses 36b through verse 41 are a recap. It's not a continuation of the narrative. John could have put that at the end of chapter 21 if he had wanted to, because it's not an event that happened on a day and time. It's a summary of the response to Jesus' entire ministry. The event that is prior to this is that passion prediction. Then is telling us this happened afterwards. But it is not a public statement. It is Jesus speaking to his disciples. And so, in verse 44, he cried out and said, "He who believes in me believes not in me." Not in me alone is the idea, not just in me, but also in him who sent me. The truth there is that Jesus does speak from a Trinitarian perspective within this entire book. And in the near future, I will do a message on John chapter 3 as a result of some of the things that I'm seeing there now that show a Trinitarian focus that I see reason to highlight more than I have seen before. It just really hit me that Jesus is making that prominent in his teaching of very early in his ministry. He does so in John chapter 3, which is before he started his Galilean ministry. Because his Galilean ministry did not start until John chapter 4, verse 45. And way there at the beginning, he is not just talking about his relationship with the Father, but also of giving indication of the role of the Holy Spirit, which receives quite a bit of attention later. I had not seen the early development of that. This symbol is often used to depict the Trinity. No human depiction adequately captures the Trinity, but in the absence of anything better, I'll put it forth. He who sees me sees him who sent me. Father and Son are in absolute unity. And so Jesus is the visible manifestation of the invisible God. Look way back at the beginning of the book. John chapter 1, verse 18, in words by John the Baptist. "No one has seen God at any time." Here from the New King James, "The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." Jesus is in a position, because of his intimacy as part of the Trinity, to reflect perfectly the Father's will. So he who sees me sees him who sent me. This is going to receive more attention in the last discourse. In verse 46, "I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness." Here we pictured the earth that has the sun shining brightly on one side and the other half is in darkness. Jesus is picturing himself as the light of the world. His comparison is with the physical sun. The capital S-O-N gives sunlight. And it makes it so that believers have the possibility of not abiding in darkness. Notice should not. It is subjunctive, and it is in other places put as a purpose clause. There's a purpose. One of the purposes of believing in Jesus is that in this life we would not abide in darkness, that we would abide in the light. But not all believers abide in the light. It's but it is his purpose here, in one of his purposes in coming into the world. Then he says, "If anyone hears my word and does not believe," this little guy certainly looks skeptical. That's in verse 47a. "If anyone hears my word and does not believe,
I do not judge him. For I did not come into the world to judge, but to deliver the world. Now, key word here is I did not come to judge, but to deliver. In his first coming, he is life giver. He is not judge. Going back to John chapter 5, just for a moment, I want you to notice Jesus is life giver now, but he will be judge. Look at John 5:21. For as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. Like Father, like Son. Father is a life giver and Jesus is a life giver. And besides giving eternal life, he resurrects, as the Father does. But then in verse 22, we have, for the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son. Now we do need to make a translation change here, because you see here in the New King James and other translations will read similarly, should honor is treated as a subjunctive, that's correct, but then the next use of honor is treated as though it's indicative, but it should also be subjunctive. The two forms are identical. It's a contract verb, so it would be allowable for it to be either indicative or subjunctive, but I would argue subjunctive makes better sense of the passage. So I will re-render this, that all would honor the Son just as they should honor the Father. Why does he speak that way? Well, he's speaking to people who wanted to kill him, verse 18, 16 and 18. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. So Jesus is not saying that those people that he's talking to honored the Father. He's saying they dishonored him because they dishonored Jesus. So therefore, it should be understood that all would honor the Son as they should honor the Father. Now, the implication. Jesus said, I didn't come to judge, but to deliver. Well, the implication, great white throne, he will come not to save, not to deliver, but to judge. Jesus is making a statement about his first coming. His first coming was to offer deliverance, that anyone who believes in him for everlasting life has it. Interestingly, in John chapter 5, those people wanted to judge Jesus and put him to death. And what he says is, I want not to judge you, but to give you life. But if you don't accept life from me, you will face him as judge. Then he says, he who rejects me and does not accept my words are what will judge him. Look at that in verse 48. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. What is it that judges him? The word that I have spoken will judge him on the last day. Why is it that Jesus' word is capable of judging the person? Well, where does his word come from? Has he not said all the way through this book, his words are the very ones that the Father has sent him to communicate? He presents himself as the loyal apprentice son who does exactly what the Father wants. And his words have been validated by his signs. And you remember at the very beginning of our passage tonight, Father, glorify your name. How will he glorify his name? By the final sign, raising the crucified Messiah. Voice came from heaven, verse 28. I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. He has glorified it through the signs, he will glorify it through the final sign, the resurrection. Now you notice that I have put in yellow, rejects and does not accept. I want you to notice that belief is what's at hand. There's a rejection of a person and there's a rejection of words. He who disbelieves me and disbelieves my words will judge him. When people talk about accepting Jesus, there are lots of fuzzy thoughts about that, but the whole concept there in John 1:12 is on this idea. One accepts Jesus by accepting as true what Jesus says. In other words, believing him for what he says. What does he say? As the Messiah, the Son of God, I give everlasting life to those who believe me forth. It says, I have not spoken on my own authority. That's the reason his words will be the basis of judgment. He's speaking the very words that the Father has commanded him to say. I have not spoken on my authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a commandment what I should say and what I should speak. Then he says in verse 50, and I know that his command is everlasting life. His command to Jesus is to do everything necessary to give everlasting life to those who simply believe him for his promise of everlasting life. And therefore, I meant to put in the words here of this, therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak. So Jesus is reinforcing to his disciples that he speaks truth because he speaks what his Father has sent him to say. He has 11 of his 12 disciples that have believed in him. A significant minority of the Pharisees in the ruling council, the Sanhedrin, have believed in him. But overwhelmingly, the nation has rejected him, even though they have never been able to trip him up in his words, they have never been able to show him to lie, they have never been able to show him guilty of sin, they have never been able to confound anything that he has said or he has done. And yet, verse 37, although he had done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him. Notice how similar this is to the preview that was given to us in the prologue to the book. He came to his own place, and his own people did not receive him. Now, if I were God, my thought would be just wipe them out. But that's not what verse 12 says, of John chapter 1. But as many of his own as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name, who are born not of bloodlines, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of a husband, but of God. Jesus perfectly reflects God's will, and his own people have rejected him and have rejected the Father. Despite that, our gracious God still has a plan for Israel. And he has a plan for planet Earth.
And part of that plan involves giving everlasting life to those who simply believe Jesus for his guaranteed promise of everlasting life. Jesus concludes his ministry by a final prediction of his passion. John then summarizes what has taken place in this book. Jesus then debriefs his disciples. And the next time that we encounter them in John will be on Thursday, the night before Jesus is crucified, as they observe Passover on the Galilean calendar.